WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Today on The Brian Lehrer Show, an exit interview with Brooklyn Borough President Marty Markowitz. What's his legacy after 12 years as Brooklyn's biggest cheerleader? And we're collecting your tweets and web postings on how Brooklyn has changed since 2001. Some call it the greatest urban success story in the United States in the last quarter century. Go to WNYC.org and click on Brian Lehrer Show or tweet at Brian Lehrer with how Brooklyn has changed in the last 12 years. And we'll talk to Marty Markowitz later in the program. Also today, we have Israel's deputy defense minister on the prospects for peace with Iran and the Palestinians, John Kerry working so hard on both, and the New York State Board of Regents chancellor braving a series of town hall meetings on the Common Core curriculum. And we'll meet a New York Hindu monk, calls himself an urban monk, later on this morning too. But first, there are officially 22,091 homeless children in New York City as of this month. Maybe you've been reading the New York Times series profiling just one of those kids, Dasani, an 11-year-old girl who lives with her seven siblings and two parents in a room at Auburn, a shelter for homeless families in Fort Greene. It's a hard look at what the poorest among us experience and how it came to be that a record number of families and children are homeless while rents rise and wealth accumulates elsewhere in the city. Joining us now is the reporter behind this remarkable Times series, which is rolling out in five parts all this week, though you can read it all online. She's Andrea Elliott. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you.
Describe a day for people who have not yet seen the series in the life of Dasani.
Dasani is now 12. When I began following her, she was 11. She was always the first to wake up. And she would wake up in a 520-square-foot room infested by mice and mold, with a leaking pipe, often very cold, insufficiently heated, in a very decrepit, poorly run shelter in a hidden corner of the gentrification gem that Fort Greene, Brooklyn has become. She shared this room until recently. I don't want to give away the end of the series, but she does remain homeless, I'll say that much. She shared this room with her parents and seven siblings. They were doubled up on mattresses that were torn. They lived in really shocking conditions. And she was always the first to wake because she is kind of a substitute parent in this household that is one room. And so she was constantly tending to the baby, the youngest of the eight. But she liked to wake up early also to just have a little moment by herself. And she early on would begin to tell me about her ritual of sitting at the window and looking out at the Empire State Building. At night, she would do this as well to see the lights. She's just incredibly she's a child who is awake to the world. That is how I would describe her. And never really pauses. She's always in motion. So her morning would be about basically getting her siblings off to school. She would often miss breakfast and get to her own school, Susan S. McKinney, which is the focus of today's story, one of the focuses, late. And that really became her substitute home. And it was there that she would find all kinds of nourishment and what really felt like home. And I'll give you the best example of it symbolically, which is in the beginning when I used to show up at school with her and watch her routine there, I noticed that she would linger by the closet in her classroom, of the classroom of Faith Hester, this remarkable teacher who was her homeroom humanities teacher. And she would just very carefully hang her coat and tuck her backpack into the corner and linger there. And it didn't strike me until later that this was actually the only closet that this child has access to. There is no closet in their room.
And so the closet that she shared with other students in the school was the only closet that she knows.
Yes, but it was a place to put her things. And I think I think there are so many ways that the experience of homelessness impacts a child. It only begins with the very fact of their homelessness, of lacking a home. It's really losses upon losses. There are so many things that a child who doesn't have a home ends up not having. And so a sense of belonging and this a sense of rootlessness, really, is how I would describe her daily life.
And so on that poignant detail, no closet in her life at home, only one at school, I want to invite listeners in, and we're going to do this in a few sections, folks. If you've been reading the article, hold off for a few minutes. If you've been reading the series and just want to react to it, we want other people who can relate to this. If this feels familiar first, maybe you have experience with child homelessness yourself or through that of a loved one. Did you spend any time in a shelter as a kid? Did you as a parent? How was it and how did you get out of that situation? If you have, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. In the spirit of Andrea Elliott's remarkable series, we want you to tell your stories. 212-433-9692. And we'll get to the policy conversation in a bit and other reactions that readers who may never have been in a situation close to this may be having. But we want to hear your personal stories. A record number of people are homeless right now. We have to acknowledge that moment as we head toward the new year and toward this big political transition in New York City. Over 50,000, and that is a record. Over 22,000 of those are children. Maybe you're a teacher who teaches one of those kids, like the hero in today's episode of this series. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, with your personal stories of child homelessness, either of yourself or someone you know. 212-433-9692. And Andrea, for people who've been reading the series already, and it's hard to miss. I mean, I don't think I've ever seen anything take up as much real estate above the fold on the front page of the New York Times as yesterday's story. So you should be very proud that the editors devoted this much.
I feel very lucky.
But I thought that people reading the series may want to hear a little of Dasani's voice before we even go any further into the details, because you have some videos online. So here is about a minute of my guest, New York Times correspondent Andrea Elliott, interviewing Dasani about what her perfect childhood would be.
In your imagination, what does the perfect childhood look like?
Quiet, flowers everywhere, sparkles on the ground. Mom and Dad always talked about a perfect childhood. Yeah, mom and dad can be drunk at a perfect childhood. Or they be nice. They give you whatever you want. They give you money, everything you ask for. Your room is always decorated nice. You always have good blingers. Your clothes will be nice. That's a perfect childhood.
Did you say drugged up?
Junked.
Junked?
Drunk.
Drunk.
Some parents, they have perfect childhoods, but sometimes they get carried away. Like, they be frustrated sometimes, and then they get drunk.
So you think that being drunk is a part of the perfect childhood? The parents are drunk?
Yes, because when they're drunk, you ask them for anything, they tell you can get it. That's a perfect childhood.
Really, Dasani, you really think a perfect childhood is your
parents? You said use my imagination.
Okay.
I used it.
Wow. And heartbreaking.
Yes.
But we learned that her parents are more happy drunks than angry drunks. She's more likely to get things she asks for.
Her parents have a long history of battling addictions. It's actually less an issue of alcohol than drugs. They currently are in methadone maintenance drug treatment programs, so they consider themselves, they feel that they have prevailed in that sense, but this has also become kind of a substitute addiction. It's illegal, basically synthetic opioid that helps people meet other addictions, and they become listless a lot of the time because of it. But yeah, she notices in just very basic ways that children will pick up on things, you know, how her parents when her parents seem the happiest, and it's directly connected to her own happiness. And I think that is, for me, that was one of the revelations of just not just that moment, but also through the course of the year, was understanding that she's tethered to her parents emotionally. She rises and falls with them. And that is, I think, one of the most devastating facts about not just Asani, but her siblings and the broader tribe of children she comes from, many of whom do not have parents who are in such desperate straits. Nearly a third of homeless children in New York have at least one parent who is working to support them. But yes, and I also really like that recording because it shows you how smart this kid is and how she pushes back. And she's able to speak for herself and very fast on her feet, incredibly intuitive for her 11 years.
The mother is named Chanel, the father, Supreme. Altogether, they have 8 children from a collection of partners. And as you say, they're not saints. Drug abuse, they haven't been able to keep jobs. They live on food stamps and a survivor benefit that Supreme is receiving after the death of his first wife. You say they're in long-term homelessness. Why did you profile this family? You didn't have to focus on a family with 8 kids, for example.
That's absolutely true. I would say that my whole approach to this issue has been to write about children. And Dasani's parents are definitely outliers. There's no question. But she and her siblings share so much in common with the experience of other homeless children that I interviewed. And I really wanted to find a kid who was compelling. She was on the honor roll when I met them, and it's also hard when you're looking for a child you can follow over time, because especially an 11-year-old, it's hard to find somebody who can really articulate what is going on inside. And actually, she wasn't easy at first. She guarded her feelings closely. But in terms of, you know, looking at this family, it's interesting. I just found them to be such compelling people. They are people of tremendous substance. And the bonds between the siblings, really, the bond there is so strong. It's almost physical. You see them moving as one anywhere they go. And I felt immediately like there was just an important story to be told in their own experience of homelessness. Are the children themselves outliers? I would argue they are not. Yes, they've been in the shelter for 3 years. The average length of stay for children now is 13 and a half months. That's the average. So it's not like, you know, most of the children that you see in shelters are just in and out. This is becoming a population that is in shelters longer than ever. And in terms of their benefits, they get food stamps. This is true. So do 1.8 million other New Yorkers. This is a number that went up by 1 million in the Bloomberg administration.
And we'll get to some of the trends and policy questions later on. But by picking this kind of family, do you leave yourself vulnerable to things like the New York Post editorial page, which decided it was its job to critique your series, and wrote today the Times and Elliot, like much of the liberal establishment, seem to think it's the city's job to provide comfortable lives to outrageously irresponsible parents. In this case, that's a couple with a long history of drug problems and difficulty holding jobs.
So that editorial, first of all, contained inaccuracies. The information that it says is not in the series is in the series. I know it's long, but if you read it, you will see it. It's interesting because the focus always goes back to the parents, whether in the critique of this kind of thing. And also in my correspondence with the city, the focus was very much on the parents. But if you look at the experience of homeless children, I mean, they cannot choose their parents any more than the rest of us can. And while the discourse is very much one of personal responsibility and self-reliance and accountability, all these things that are very much about the adult population, you know, children are kind of unwitting passengers in this journey. They're no more to blame for their homelessness than for their existence. And so I don't think that it makes us vulnerable. I think they were the right family.
Andrea Elliott, my guest on WNYC, the New York Times correspondent, writing the remarkable and long but worth the read series in the New York Times, rolling out all this week and already completely there on their website, about 11-year-old, now 12-year-old Dasani, a homeless child in Fort Greene. And as I said, our first calls are going to come from any of you who have yourself been homeless children or touched the lives of homeless children. Maybe you're a teacher. Maybe you're a parent or a neighbor. 212-433-WNYC to hear some more stories that need to be told at a moment in the city's history with record homelessness and record child homelessness, 22,091 officially homeless children in New York City as of this month. Han in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hello, Han.
Yes, hi.
What about your story would you like to tell us?
Yes, yeah, so like I said, it's actually twofold. I was staying with my son by my mother and stepfather, and they got into an argument and they threw me out, and I had to stay with him in the past Bronx shelter. And there was another story. I had my car accident in Muncie and Route 59. I was in Ike Hospital. It was a Sunday, and I told them I didn't have any place to stay, and they just sent me home. So I was actually homeless.
Han, thank you. Thank you for your story. And I'm going to have to go because the line is so bad, people can hardly understand you. Andrea, you're right that it's Dasani's belief that she and her siblings are the cause of her mother's ruin. It never occurs to her, for example, that for Chanel, her mom, the children represent her only accomplishment. Explain how that plays out.
I think that it goes a little bit to what I was saying earlier about Dasani's inability really to separate herself from the emotional peaks and valleys of her parents as well as those of her siblings. She does not see herself as a part, as an individual. Yeah. She very much exists in the context of these other people, and to the point where I don't think she even really sees herself as separate. And so one of the ways in which it plays out is, and this I saw this again and again, and her principal, Paula Holmes at McKinney, also noticed this about her, as well as Faith Hester, her teacher, and others. The very qualities that could help her in life and that make her that potentially could save her, her strengths, her intelligence, her agility, are both her salvation and potentially her undoing, because those are the very things that make her so indispensable to her mother primarily, who is really overwhelmed with these children and very little help from the father. And so Dasani has stepped in, and so it's just an irony that the things that could rescue her also end up potentially getting in the way.
Dominique in Queens, you're on WNYC. Hello, Dominique. Dominique hung up, or we lost her line. And how about John in Queens? John, you're on WNYC. Hello.
How are you?
Okay,
first of all, I want to thank the author for putting this article in the New York Times. Child homelessness, it's a crisis in New York City. Having worked with it for more than 20 years, I can attest that the situation under which children exist in the city shelters are appalling.
You work in the shelters? Is that what I understand?
In the shelters, correct. They're appalling. They're in old schools. They're in old hospitals. These are buildings that are decrepit, that are falling down, ceilings falling down, bathrooms falling down. You got families that are cramped into little storage boxes, I call them, you know, no bigger than the size of a single bed. And they're forced to fit into these rooms. You know, something has to be done. You know, it's Christmas now. It's Hanukkah just passed, Thanksgiving. These kids are looking for toys, clothes. It's tragic. You know, I don't want to go into details.
John, why is there so little attention to the need for repairs and maintenance? We're going to get into that brutal aspect of this series in a minute. But do you have the same experience in the shelters you've been working at? And if so, why is it so hard to get a response?
It's all about priority. It's what the administration or the mayor at the time sees as priority. It's what the commissioner of an agency sees as priority. It's what the directors that are responsible for maintaining these facilities see as priority. Everything has to be budgeted. Everything has to be planned out. And, you know, people forget that children are little men and little women. They are the ones that will rise up tomorrow and govern our society. And these kids are neglected. I mean, it's tragic. You know, I can't even talk about it.
John, I really appreciate you chiming in, though. So, Andrea Elliott, talk about the shelter itself, this aspect of the story, and there's a lot of this in the part of the series that's published in today's print edition. This part of the story is so shocking. It's the Auburn Family Shelter in Fort Greene, ironically a very gentrified, increasingly gentrified neighborhood in central Brooklyn. You point out that Auburn has a bad record, both in terms of health and building violations. You were talking before about some of the mice and mold and so forth. Plus, there are complaints of abuse, sexual harassment. From what you know, is this an exceptional case or is this typical of the family shelter system in the city today?
You know, there's no easy answer to that. I think people who are very familiar with hundreds of shelters out there would argue, you know, a range of things. There's some people who say that maybe about 50% of shelters have problems within the range of this. Others would say Auburn is among the worst. In the city's own ranking, it's actually not the worst. It's near the bottom, but it's not the worst. So it's one of four shelters operated directly by the city. The remaining shelters are tend to be run by nonprofits, and I think a lot of those shelters are more accountable to boards of directors and keep conditions better. And there are some shelters that are great, so there really is a range. What happened here, I think, in part, is that it used to be a hospital; it wasn't really built to accommodate families living in a homeless shelter. There are these congregate spaces, congregate bathrooms, congregate dining. And so the infrastructure, the city has made the point to me, is a big part of the problem. They're just constantly trying to do repairs, but obviously the repairs have been insufficient. And I think the more shocking thing, which came to my attention through documents I obtained that outline these sort of handwritten complaints that were made internally at the shelter by residents, show a pattern of things really just going wrong that are not addressed, including sexual abuse of minors, or at least reported sexual abuse of minors. So that is, it's no place for children.
When we come back from a break, I want to find out if the city has already responded to the description of the conditions at the shelter in the article and that you were just laying out verbally. And we also can open up the phones more widely now to anybody who's been reading this series in the New York Times, again in the print edition yesterday and today, and will continue through the week, or if you've seen the whole thing online by Andrea Elliott, you can call up now with your reactions, questions, comments, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, or post online to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and we're talking with New York Times correspondent Andrea Elliott, author of the remarkable series in the Times this week, profiling one of the 22,000-plus homeless children in New York City, Dasani, who lives with her seven siblings and two parents in a room at Auburn, a shelter for homeless families in Fort Greene. And we'll get to some more of your phone calls for Andrea Elliott in just a minute. But Andrea, I want you to talk about Dasani's experience of living in Fort Greene, if you can. This is a neighborhood that is emblematic of the greater changes in Brooklyn and the rest of the city. This past decade, Fort Greene, some say, is very unequal. Others just say it's diverse. What is Dasani's experience of the wealth imbalance in her neighborhood?
Well, what was so fascinating to me is that her family, her roots reach back a long way in Fort Greene to her great-grandmother, who raised eight children in the Ingersoll housing projects right near Auburn. And Dasani herself was born in Fort Greene. And so the difference, I think, between her experience as a child living in poverty and that of the women who came before her is so different, in the sense that back when they were going through some of the same struggles, they were much more, I think, in an enclave that was defined by poverty, whereas she is constantly exposed to things that are out of her reach because of the just really the transformation of this neighborhood over the last decade. Dasani is...
Are we supposed to think it's better, though, to be in a isolated, economically segregated area than to be in a Fort Greene where she can see that there's another side?
No, I wouldn't take the position that anybody is supposed to see it in any particular way. I my role was to just show it as it is for her, and I think that was, for me, one of the revelatory things, and I think I did expect her experience to be one that was more cordoned off, when in fact she's engaging constantly with people of, you know, just really, really different financial circumstances. And I think that there's a lot of good in that for her, because she's exposed to what she might be able to achieve. But truly, her greatest role models come at the school. That is where she finds. And these are women who, one in particular, Faith Hester, who came up and out of the Marcy Projects and, you know, found her way through college and two master's degrees, and becomes a very influential person in the year that I follow Dasani. And so...
Is it possible for you to discern whether, for Dasani, seeing the other Fort Greene is a source of discouragement and despair and resentment, or a source of hope to know that there's something else out there?
So... The other Fort Greene for her is not a Fort Greene so much defined by wealth as by race. So what she is responding to a lot when we talk is the white people who have come. And I think she feels very apart because of that. I think if she saw more examples, and I think that there is a lot of diversity among the professional class that has moved in, of course, and also was there before. But what she's really charts this difference in along lines of race, and I think that she's just very aware of being on the outside, of not belonging, and I think she even feels, it's interesting, like she doesn't belong within her own bubble, because there, where Auburn is, which is tucked behind Myrtle, north of Myrtle Avenue, behind the project, the Whitman housing development, she's really surrounded by kids who have more financial stability than she does. And so to the rest of society, they may seem like they're at the bottom, but actually, in their eyes, she occupies a lower rung.
Jack in New Rochelle, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jack.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. So overall, my question is whether the reporter has formed a view about poverty and what to do about it. More specifically, obviously, this is a heartbreaking story, as they all are. And I have, in my life, known poverty. Not, I was never destitute, but, you know, we lived off of rationed food at some point, and I had lived on little bags of ramen at some point, and I've made my way, and I've done well. And I know what it took. And I wonder whether, and by the way, it's obvious, it should be obvious, that this drive, this reportage, is driven by a political point of view. It's the White House agenda now.
Why would that be obvious to you?
Because suddenly it's a talk of the town. I mean, poverty was there the week before and the week before that, but when the White House started to talk about poverty, so did the New York Times and other. And that's fine. Poverty needs to be addressed. The other shoe in this is that the White House has a solution, which I think is a silly solution. It's a bankrupt solution. The solution is to enable people to help themselves, not to live lives that are managed by a municipality that does a poor job of it. And I just wonder, frankly, whether the reporter, who is obviously emotionally involved with this, has formed an idea or a view of what to do here.
Well, first of all, I would disagree that politics drove this series. At the time that I began exploring the issue of child poverty, it was very much not being discussed. It was not really brought up at all during the last presidential debates.
But we should say that Mayor Bloomberg, by his own statistics, says and is despairing of the fact that as he leaves office, 46% of the residents of New York City are poor or near poor, as the mayor's office puts it. That's lost on nobody, and it's not driven by the White House. And inequality, obviously, was such a major issue in the mayoral campaign. So just to put a little more context on that.
Right, absolutely. In terms of policy prescriptions, I have to say, you know, I think that there are no easy answers, and especially when you look specifically at this family. It's very hard to know what needs to be done. But I think that what's clear is that steering the debate a little bit away from this emphasis on the adults and where they have fallen short, and more towards the children that are basically stuck in the position, in the circumstances of their parents' making, makes sense to me, because whether, whatever role government or society ends up playing in these children's lives, what's indisputable is that that role does make a difference. And so the question is how best to serve them, and what do you really see making a difference? And I think in terms specifically of this family and where the city fell short and where it didn't, well, I'll start with where it didn't. I mean, the school, even though it's strained under budget cuts because its population has gone down, has heroically, to my mind, and I don't think that that is – I think that is a fair assessment – filled in for this child in all kinds of ways. They have – and they do this for other children too, obviously. So they've become a substitute home. But when you look at, obviously, the food stamps that the family receives, as I said before, a million more New Yorkers are on food stamps than in 2002. It's now to 1.8 million. So they are hardly alone in that's just another.
And let me ask you one policy question at the local level. Mayor Bloomberg's approach to homelessness, which you write about in the article, in November 2004, the mayor ended the policy that people in shelters got on the priority public housing list. Instead, the city began offering homeless families time-limited rental assistance through a program called Advantage. Then in 2011, Mayor Bloomberg ended the Advantage program after the state withdrew its funding. 6 months later, the city's homeless population hit its record, including more than 16,000 kids. That was 2 years ago. Now it's 22,000 kids. Why did the Advantage program not get funded?
Well, there are a lot of theories about this, but I mean, basically, this was in the wake of the recession and the state was making cuts. And I think that the city believed that the program worked. Roughly a quarter of those families wound up homeless again. But I think the bigger picture here is that when you go back to the first decision to end priority referrals into long-term affordable housing, critics of that policy would argue that that really did remove a place for families to go, that a policy that by some measures really worked for families. And so when you replace that with short-term rental assistance, I think that the emphasis there is on getting families to land on their own feet. And going to that caller's point, you know, children are along for the ride. They don't really have a say in how to make the rent. And when you look at this family specifically, the city ended up spending about $400,000 housing them between these rental subsidy programs. There were two, by the way. There was one before Advantage. And with shelter, the city spends about $3,000 a month putting families in shelters. And I think that some of those families are end up in great shelters and have a lot of services. What happened at Auburn? Where did that money go? What I saw was no on-site child care. That was cited in state inspections. No assistance finding affordable housing. The last housing specialist on staff died 4 years ago, was never replaced. One recreation room shared by hundreds of kids, operated by one staff member until recently. Now it's three. Meals that often contain spoil food or are served frozen need to be reheated in one of two microwaves shared by hundreds of residents. So the idea that, you know, the city did its part to help this family specifically doesn't match up to the reality that I saw in terms of just sheer dollars and looking at, but the school really became the I think this child's salvation this year. I think it kind of stood between her and a much more dire set of problems.
And the Post editorial argues that for this family, the critique should not be against the government. We should think of the government as overly generous, in their opinion. And whether one agrees or not, you point out that the government is paying more to house this family in a shelter than they had been paying in the temporary rental assistance that then got ended. So does this reveal a real inefficiency in dealing with homelessness with our tax dollars? And has the city responded to any of this now that it's out and causing so much conversation, either with respect to the horrifying conditions that you describe at Auburn or to these savage inefficiencies in the way our tax dollars are being used?
Well, for one thing, it's important to note that Mayor Bloomberg did direct near about $5 billion to homeless services and really set out to try to revamp the system. And so there were a lot of changes and some improvements, certainly, citywide. There was this program that began that put satellite offices around the city to help people try to prevent homelessness by offering job training and counseling and short-term financial assistance. The city has not responded, not yet.
Christina in Queens. You're on WNYC. Hello, Christina.
Hello. I enjoy your show every morning.
Thank you.
I worked as a social worker in the Board of Ed for many years. And when I first started working as a social worker and came in contact with the families in shelter or about to go into shelters, the average stay was 10 months. I've been retired from the Board of Ed for 4 years, and I'm still in contact with a family 4 years later, so they've been in the shelter approximately 5 years. There's three children and a mother. And the what really struck my heart the first time or second time I met this mother, she said to me, "I'm nothing if I don't work." She is an advocate, and she really pushes her children to get an education. Education to her is primary.
So in the context of that experience, what's your reaction to the articles?
I have not read the article, I must say. I did go out and get the Times today. I haven't read it, but I thank that writer from the bottom of my heart. It needs to be brought out there, and hopefully this will cause some reaction that will give services to this family, because as I was telling the other person, I feel guilty. I have a home and they have a one room. And I said, this isn't right. This isn't fair. And I've spoken to my husband about bringing the family home. And he said, you can't do this. You know, that it's not going to work. And
this other family that you knew.
That this family that I still know and have been in contact over the past four years. And it's heartbreaking. One of the children, the younger one, has developmental problems, which is another issue. The mother works when she can in a church. She's a hard worker.
What do you think, short of bringing the family into your home, would help them?
Getting them in an apartment, a home where they can cook and live like normal people, whatever that is these days, I don't know.
Christina, thank you so much for your call. Here is Catherine calling from Brooklyn, who I think teaches at one of the schools referenced in the article. Catherine, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for taking my call. I guess I have sort of a negative call. As a school teacher, when I read the article last night, actually on Facebook, I was a little dumbfounded that here we are talking about this again, which as teacher, this is part of what we do. And I've been in the school district for almost 25 years in District 13. And homeless children and situational poverty are just part of what we do. And I think for me as an artist in these schools, I was a little offended by the comparison to LaGuardia. I've sent amazing students to McKinney, artists, musicians, dancers, and I think that's one of the problems is we keep comparing our children here in District 13 in Fort Greene to LaGuardia kids.
The school
and
her
teacher,
I think we've been hearing that the school and Dasani's teacher in particular come off as the biggest heroes in this story.
I know, I'm just took offense to the writer comparing, making that LaGuardia comparison.
Mm-hmm.
I sent my daughter to LaGuardia years ago and took her out of LaGuardia for other reasons, with Martin Luther King next door and the problems with the LaGuardia students and the Martin Luther King students. So it's not the end all.
Right. Catherine, thank you.
Absolutely. I take your point. This is not my comparison. It's the comparison that I hear all the time among the staff there. And it's interesting also the dancer, Dasani's a dancer. She loves to dance. And the dancer she admires most in the school is this very gifted girl who ended up going, making it through and getting into LaGuardia. And that doesn't end up in the series. But, you know, it's something that hovers over a lot of these kids is this idea that they can get someplace else, that if only by some stroke of luck, you know, they are fortunate enough to break out, they can make it. And what's interesting to me is that is not an idea that Dasani has given herself over to. She doesn't subscribe to that fantasy. She doesn't allow herself to dream that way, because I think that her experience of homelessness has seared into her conscience, this idea that there are just that life is a series of losses, and so better not to get attached, even if it's to certain dreams. But then things happen that are really surprising that I won't give away, although you can read the whole series online. But in Friday's story, you will see there's just a huge stroke of serendipity that came along.
So we're just about out of time, but I want to acknowledge that many of our commenters on our webpage, and folks, you can keep that conversation going even after Andrea Elliott is gone, at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. But a lot of commenters are asking how they can help. Is there a way that some of your readers and our listeners can help Dasani or other homeless families with similar situations?
So it's definitely not our role, the New York Times, that is, to be involved in any way in financial assistance or anything like that. But you should know that the Legal Aid Society has actually taken on this role. They have set up a trust that they are going to manage for the children, and they are asking that any such inquiries go to them. They have an email I can give you. It's invisiblechild@legal-aid.org.
That was invisiblechild@legal-aid.org?
Yes.
And it is an exceptional presentation of a story. both exceptional because it's powerful and well done, but also exceptional because the Times doesn't often give huge front page placement every day for a week on a story like this. So congratulations on doing all of this reporting and drawing such attention to what is still, as the Legal Aid Society's email address suggests, an invisible problem to so many of the New Yorkers who are not among the 22,091, the official number as of this month, homeless children in the city. So, Andrea Elliott, New York Times correspondent, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.